You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds. Chat with Traders is sponsored by Trade the Pool. Are concerns about limited buying power, insufficient capital, or fear of losing your own money preventing you from advancing your trading capabilities? Trade the Pool is an online stock trading prop firm that offers funding for stock traders. Demonstrate your skills, trade their capital, and keep your profits. You can engage in intraday trading and now swing trading on Trade the Pool with any U.S. stock or ETF. The procedure is straightforward. Pay an evaluation fee, successfully complete the evaluation, and get funded. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Markets, speculation, and risk. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, hosted by Aaron Fifield.
Hey folks, how you doing? Welcome once again to Chat with Traders podcast. The feature on this episode is someone who I had the great pleasure of meeting and speaking with at QuantCon 2017 in New York City. Xiao Chow is a research analyst for a Connecticut-based hedge fund focused on trading commodity futures. Prior to this point, he completed a PhD in finance and was a teaching assistant to renowned economist Eugene Fama. And notably, Xiao has also worked directly with trading legend Blair Hull on two quantitative research projects, which concern market timing and return predictability. White papers for both of these can be found in the show notes at chatwithtraders.com/153. The main objective of this episode with Xiao is to learn how a research analyst thinks about things directly related to research and ways that you can do better market research for yourself. On top of this, Xiao, based on his experience, shares a few tips for those who have an urge to study something but are unsure about what to study, and some of the differences he's observed between the world of academia and working as a practitioner. Please welcome Xiao Chow for episode 153. So one of the first things I wanted to ask you, Xiao, is what pushed you in the direction or at least attracted you to finance? Like before grad school and before you decided what you were going to study, all of that, what actually turned you on to finance?
So I first started in college. I did a variety of things. I studied a little bit of engineering, a little bit of math, finance, and statistics, because I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do. And I realized what I wanted, or what I liked rather, is applied mathematics. And so I always thought I was going to be an engineer. Both my parents are engineers. So I did some material science engineering. I enjoy that, but I didn't enjoy working in a lab. But I did enjoy the applied mathematics side, and I wanted to not work in a lab, still get good data, and keep on using the math background I had. So finance is a natural laboratory for that, in that the data for finance is very, very good. Stock return data is very precise and easily available. And it would allow me to continue to apply the same tools I have been applying in engineering or statistics. And also I enjoyed some of the core finance idea, like the time value of money or risk neutral pricing, some of these ideas just really appealed to me. So I thought I want to dig a little bit deeper. So that's how I decided I would go to grad school in finance.
Okay. And when we talk about applied math, what sort of things does that cover?
So what I have in mind in particular are, I guess, probability theory, applied statistics, things like linear algebra, real analysis, these sort of things.
Right. And then when you went to grad school, what was it that you actually studied there?
So the program name, I suppose, is a PhD in finance. And so the initial training is broadly similar, and you actually end up taking the same classes as the economics students in the economics department at the University of Chicago. So which means microeconomics, macroeconomics, and econometrics in the first year. And then you take some finance-specific classes like asset pricing or corporate finance. Then afterwards, you start to drill down a little bit narrower into the research area you're most interested in. And that, for me, meant asset pricing. So that means working with specific asset pricing researchers and try to really hone your skills there.
Okay. So I want to ask you this question. I feel like you're a good person who might be able to shine a little bit of light on the subject. But I've had a few emails from people lately, seems to be a few more than normal, specifically asking about or seeing if, you know, asking me for advice. I don't think I'm really the right person to give it, but, you know, considering you've taken this path, you know, people are a little bit unsure about what sort of things they might want to study. Like, how did you know that you were making the right choice? And did you know going into your grad program what you wanted to do coming out the other side of it?
Sure, that's a great question, and I'm not sure if I'm entirely qualified to speak broadly about that question, but I can share my experience. So in terms of deciding what to study, I think the best thing to do is just try to explore early on, as early as you can, because it's not always clear what you like today is going to be what you like tomorrow, especially in your late teens or early 20s. I think a lot of your ideas become solidified and your thoughts change quite a bit. So that was certainly true for me. I went to college thinking I was going to be some sort of engineer. My dad's a mechanical engineer, so I thought maybe I want to do something like that. But once I got to college, I realized, you know, maybe I want to do something similar to engineering, but not exactly engineering. So then I explored a little bit more in statistics and finance and found that I actually enjoy finance more than the engineering that I was studying, material science. So I think what worked for me is that really just trying to take classes in different fields and try to you know, talk to faculty or talk to maybe slightly older people who have chosen, who have had some experience in their respective fields to try to get their perspective what the field is about. Just try to gather information in that sense and then try to make a more informed decision.
Okay, and we'll get to this in a bit, but you are a research analyst today. When you were going through this grad program, is that the specific thing that you wanted to do when you came out of it? Or even going through the program, were you still a little bit unsure about what role you might slot into afterwards?
You know, I'm not sure even now if this is, you know, if I made the right choices. I think we all sort of have this self-doubt continuously, no matter where you are. And I'm not sure if there is any way to necessarily absolutely get around that. So I would maintain the same advice, is just try to explore your options. So going into grad school, typically, at least in the U.S., what grad school entails is they try to train you to become an academic. So going to grad school, the expectation for both the program director and for the student, me in this case, the expectation for everybody is that you're going to be an academic, or you're going to be trained to become an academic. So that's what I thought I was going to be going into the finance PhD program at the University of Chicago. As I explored more of the program and more aspects of academia, I found that perhaps I would enjoy working in industry as a practitioner more compared to life as an academic. And that was more of a personal choice than anything, is out of preference to have some more freedom. So then I decided I would get a job in industry rather than get an academic job or get a faculty position somewhere. So I think it comes down to a combination of preferences and opportunities. And these things, unfortunately, are always changing. So you really have to keep an open mind and just try to explore what you can.
No, I think that's really sound advice. And during this time, I don't know the proper word for the relationship, but you either learned from these two people, they were lecturers or I don't know, you can correct me here. Fama and Hansen, I've just got their last names here in my notes. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to learn from them? Like, these are two, from my understanding, quite well-respected names in academia, right?
Yeah, absolutely. These are two absolute giants in finance, economics in general. And I'm very fortunate to have had the opportunity to interact with them. So I've interacted in different capacities. So for Fama, I was actually his teaching assistant for the asset pricing class he's taught for the past 50 years. So I got to know Fama a little bit better than Hansen. And what I learned from Fama is you have to be very precise and concise in your exposition. When you talk about ideas, especially when you write academic research papers, you really don't want to use more words than you have to. And you want to be very clear exactly what you mean. And I didn't really quite appreciate this, especially coming out of college. I thought maybe the content is more important than the presentation. But I think one of the main things I learned in grad school is being able to communicate your content is equally as important, if not more important. Another thing I learned from Fama is how to learn to read tables very carefully. I've directly asked Fama this, and I said, Gene, how come you're so sensitive to these numbers in tables? You go to a presentation and you immediately point out and say, hey, this number doesn't make much sense. And the researcher goes back and realizes maybe he's made a mistake. How do you do that? And Fama said, well, you really just have to think about these things carefully, read the paper before you come, and think through what are some constraints on what the possible numbers are maybe in a regression table. So since then, I've taken reading tables much more seriously, and now I try to really think deep about both the economic meaning behind all the empirical work we do, but also try to be sensitive to the numbers. For Lars Hansen, I didn't quite interact with him in research capacity. I think our research interests were a little bit different, but I did take three classes with him, and what I got out of Hansen is to take economics seriously. The economics is not just a fun set of abstractions for the ivory tower for the academic researcher, but it's actually an important tool that we can use to understand the world. I guess in that sense, I try to apply economic thinking in everyday life, try to apply what Hansen has taught us.
Okay. So as you mentioned there, you worked, I guess, more closely with Fama. Mm-hmm. How did that opportunity come about? Like, how were you fortunate enough to get into that position? Did you just happen to be in the right class and build a bit of a relationship with him? Or like, how did that opportunity come about?
So Fama teaches this, the first out of a series of required finance PhD classes, actually. And so every finance student has to take it, and many economics students and some MBA students also take this class. So I took this class early on, and every year Fama picks his TAs. He picks two teaching assistants from the previous year who has taken the class in the previous year. So I suppose I did reasonably well in this class, and the two TAs who I had recommended that I'd be chosen to serve as the teaching assistant for the following year. And fortunately for me, Fama agreed. So that's how that opportunity came about.
Makes sense. Very good, man. Now, how long was the grad program that you went through?
You know, I think the length differs by the individual, but typically these days for the finance program, it's about 5 years from the day you enter the program to the day you leave the program.
Okay. And that's considered or classified as full-time?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I'm not sure whereabouts this came into the picture, but you linked up with Blair Hull. How did this opportunity come about?
Yeah, so I think there is a lot of serendipity at work here. So I was working through my PhD program. I was trying to write a doctoral dissertation to graduate. And then one day I got an email from this guy, Blair Hull, actually from his personal assistant. I said he wants to write a white paper on market timing. So I think I've heard of the name Blair Hull at some point in just my leisure readings. So I Googled who he was. And he's this big shot trader who sold his company to Goldman Sachs in the late 90s for an absurd amount of money. So that was interesting. And I also noted that he played blackjack. And while in college, I actually enjoyed playing blackjack quite a bit. So I emailed him back and said, hey, I've also played some blackjack, but I've also thought about market timing a little bit. So can we talk? So I went to Blair's office and we chatted for an hour, hour and a half, and we just hit it off on both market timing and blackjack. And at the end of that chat, Blair said, hey, let's work together. Let's write this paper and think about the research.
Just like that, eh?
Yeah, I think I was quite fortunate in that sense.
So how did you said you got an email from his personal assistant, but I presume that he must have discovered you somehow. Like, how did you come onto his radar?
Yeah, sorry, maybe I wasn't entirely clear there. So I believe what had happened was I think Blair was searching for somebody with some academic training to write this paper. So the email was only directed at me, but I think also at my PhD classmates. And I'm not sure if he also sent similar emails to other schools in the area, in the Chicago area, or not. So I think he sort of just was spreading a wide net trying to find a co-author to write this paper.
Okay. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you around this is, how come he reached out to someone like yourself? Like, you know, Blair has a team, you know, he's got Ketchum Trading nowadays, and there's a few other companies he has as well, like the ETF,
right,
etc. Surely he has like researchers on his team already who he could work with. How come he sort of reached out to someone who he'd never worked with before to work on this project?
So my understanding, and I don't want to speak too much for Blair here. So my understanding of the situation is, I think Blair has attempted to write a white paper a couple of times in the past before we worked together. And these white papers were interesting, but I don't think they were exactly at the level to be published in a top journal. So I think Blair maybe wanted just a little bit of academic touch on the paper itself, to sort of get over the hurdle so we can to have some legitimacy, be published in a good journal. So that's sort of what we did in the end. So Blair and I wrote this paper called the A Practitioner's Defense of Return Predictability, forecasting a 6-month ahead equity risk premium. And eventually we got it published in the Journal Portfolio Management, which is a widely read practitioner publication.
Okay. Now I want to dig into this a little more because it's a massive opportunity on your part to be able to work with Blair Howe, and I'm sure it was an enjoyable experience. When you first started working with Blair, you know, we know Blair coming from a blackjack background, like he was big in blackjack before he ever came into trading. When you were speaking with Blair about, you know, his trading and thoughts on markets and investing, etc., was it obvious to you that there was still a blackjack influence which carried over into how he thought about financial markets?
I think the short answer is yes, absolutely. Actually, as much as I enjoy playing blackjack myself and all the blackjack books and blackjack education I put upon myself, I didn't realize, I guess Blair was very low-key about this. I didn't realize how big of a deal Blair was in the blackjack community. In fact, Ken Houston, who made this idea of team play famous. So team play is the idea that you have a team of blackjack players and you have a whole bunch of players scattered at different tables. And if one table gets hot, he or she at the table signals for the big player to come in and bet really big. So this idea was later popularized by the MIT blackjack team. And it was later made into the movie 21. And I realized that I think Blair actually had a lot to do with Ken Houston's team. So that was a very cool connection. So given that Blair was so heavily involved in blackjack, certainly, I think some aspects of blackjack come out. So there's a few maxims, if you will, here. So one is, don't play if you don't have an edge. So in blackjack, the idea of keeping track of the cards that have been dealt is so you have a good idea of what the time varying edge you have in betting. And that ranges from positive to negative. And when you don't have an edge, when the edge is to the house, you want to bet as small as you can, maybe the table minimum. In fact, at one point, maybe in the 60s or 70s, you're allowed to just stand behind the table and watch and not bet at all until the table gets hot. These days, I think that behavior gets caught very quickly and the casinos don't like it very much. So the first thing is don't play if you don't have an edge. Now, if you do have an edge, apparently sizing your bet is still very important. And you have to remove emotions from investing once you've had your edge. And I say investing here because I think Blair thought of blackjack as investing rather than gambling. He thought of it as a serious job. So that you know, it's a job that he knew he had a system that worked, and he followed it religiously. And I think you see that in Blair's Ketchum Trading as well as the Hall Tactical, the ETF company.
Yeah, that's funny you bring that up, actually, because when I interviewed Blair on the podcast, I think if anyone's interested in that, I think it was episode 85, he spoke about all of those things. I mean, that was one of the big things I took away from that that interview with Blair, and I've repeated this a few times through various different mediums. If you don't have an edge, there's no reason to play. Like, that's just like ingrained in me now after speaking with Blair.
It sounds so simple, but it's, if you think about it, it's actually quite deep. And I think maybe a little too many people try to play when don't have an edge.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like I've said, if traders actually, you know, especially newer traders actually understood that line and what it actually means to have an edge, they'd probably save themselves a lot of money and a lot of heartache.
I completely agree.
Yeah. So why was it that you guys wanted to study or not study, but research market timing?
So I think for Blair, of course, who of course has had a much longer career before he's ever met me, I think he's thought about market timing for quite a while. And for me, I came about market timing because I was thinking about new predictive analytics. I guess some people call these things machine learning. How to apply some of these tools into finance, and predictability seems like a very natural place to do this. So there is why tackle this question? Well, there's been a debate about the feasibility of market timing, and there's been a stigma, if you will, associated with market timing in the past. So the debate has proponents on both sides. So Robert Merton, the 1997 Nobel laureate, as early as 1980, said that it wasn't really possible to time the market at all, or even to estimate the equity premium very well. Whereas a more recent paper by two academics, Goyal and Welch, showed that many of the return predictors that have worked well in the past don't work very well out of sample. So these are the guys that say you can't time the market, you can't even really predict returns very well. Whereas on the other side, early work by Farmer and French and Campbell and Shiller in the late 80s both showed that using the price-dividend ratio, we can actually capture some expected return variation associated with future returns. And more recently, John Cochrane wrote a paper in 2008 that offers a strong argument in favor of predictability. So is really in this background of not having a completely resolved question that Blair and I found this challenge interesting, because much of the academic research is about statistical power, whether you can actually find statistically significant predictability. And the fact that several of these papers, actually many of these papers now, show that you can establish some statistical power in forecasting returns, I guess Blair and my take on this question is, well, if you are able to forecast returns, what does this mean economically? If you're able to construct a market timing strategy with this knowledge, can you actually form a successful trading strategy? And that's essentially our research question in the paper. And I think that's also, I will say more broadly, our research agenda in thinking about predictability and turning it into a actual trading strategy.
Right. And just to be clear, what exactly is market timing referring to? Like, is that just identifying good times to be invested in the market and then times to be out of the market as well? Or is there a little more to it?
Yeah. So in what I just said, I mixed up. I was using two terms more or less interchangeably. I said market timing and return predictability. So return predictability refers to whether you can forecast future market returns at all. So given all we can see is historical data standing at time today, can we say something about what future returns may look like? So that's a statistical exercise trying to forecast the market. Now, if you are able to forecast the market, then potentially you can use that knowledge of where the market may go and adjust your position, adjust your market exposure. And that is, to your point, what you said about do you want to overweight or underweight your position to sort of tactically take advantage of this knowledge. So I will call that market timing.
Okay. And when you say forecast returns, how specific are you trying to be? Like, are you trying to say that 5 days from now, the S&P 500 will be up 5%? Or are you trying to say, you know, there's a 80% probability that it's going to be up more than 5% over the next 5 days, and then 20% it might be, you know, less than that? Or, like, how specific are you trying to be when you talk about forecasting returns?
So, of course, we want to be as specific as we can. But unfortunately, given that the information set you ever have is only up to the day you're making this prediction, you don't know what will happen in the future. And which means your forecast error, there's only so much you can do to control how large forecast error may be. So I think it's very difficult to make the statement like the first one that you mentioned, something about maybe a week from now, return will be 5%. I think that's extremely difficult to make. All you can say is, in all likelihood, in the next 5 days, the return will be centered around some number. But the variance of that number may be very large. So there is a lot of uncertainty associated with return predictability. But I think perhaps the important takeaway here is that even though you can't make a precise statement about exactly where returns are going to go, if you have an idea where it's going to go, then you can do something about it. And that's what market timing is all about.
Okay. So ultimately, what was like the outcome of this paper and the research project?
So what we found is that there are all these academic papers talking about different return predictors, different variables that we can use to forecast the equity premium at different frequencies, actually. And we thought about combining these return predictors. So there's some academic work by Alan Timmerman at UCSD, as well as some St. Louis academics on model combination or forecast combinations already. But they don't quite necessarily go after the economic importance. So they don't try to construct a trading strategy. So Blair and I took a similar approach in combining return predictors. And we showed that if we combine 20 return predictors, that actually leads to strong enough forecasting results to build a trading strategy. So our forecasting target is going to be the 6 month ahead market excess returns. And what we find is that from 2001 through 2015, a backtest of our market timing strategy is able to achieve twice the average returns of the S&P 500 during the same period with only half the volatility, thereby quadrupling the Sharpe ratio of buy and hold. So the strategy is only taking positions in SPY, the S&P 500 ETF, based on our statistical model. So it's, in the end, it's a very simple strategy that overweights, underweights the market. But the outcome, I think, is sort of remarkable in that all you're trying to do is forecast where the market is going and take positions related to your forecast, and you can actually do much better compared to the market.
Right. And I'm not sure if this would be detailed in the paper, which is available, but can you give us an example or a couple examples of just a few of these return predictors that you mentioned?
Sure. I mean, all of this is public information. The paper, as I mentioned earlier, is published in the journal Portfolio Management. And it's also available for free download on Social Sciences Research Network, or SSRN, if you like more details. But I can give a few examples of the return predictors. So more traditional return predictors such as price ratios. So variables such as dividend price ratio, price earnings ratio. Robert Shiller likes to use this CAPE, cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio. So we include all of these price variables, which have been shown to be able to forecast returns, especially at longer horizons. But also some newer variables that have shown up in the literature more recently, such as the variance risk premium, which we found to be a very strong return predictor at around the 3-month horizon. So the variance risk premium is the difference between the implied volatility of the options on the S&P 500 futures or the VIX index minus the realized volatility of the S&P 500. So it's the difference between implied and realized volatility, and it's persistently positive over time. But there is significant time variation, and it's this time variation does appear to be associated with future market returns.
Cool. Well, what I'll do is I'll find a link to the paper, and I'll put that in the show notes. So if anyone wants to read into this a little more and get some more context around it, it's all detailed in the white paper.
Great. And I want to mention that this white paper is forecasting returns 6 months ahead. But recently, Blair and I and one of Blair's colleagues, Petra, we put out a new white paper forecasting 1 month ahead market returns. So here, the goal is similar. We're trying to combine predictors now with a slightly different methodology compared to the first paper. But now the forecasting horizon is different. So the contribution from each return predictor, and we use a slightly different set as well, will look different compared to the first white paper as well. So if you're interested, this paper is also available on SSRN.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll get a direct link from you when we wrap this up. Yeah, awesome.
You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. They started at the beginning, reimagining the bond screener with an intuitive design that helps you zero in on the exact kinds of bonds you're looking for. Then they made it easier to evaluate each investment opportunity with better data in the places you need it most. Finally, they made investing in bonds as straightforward as stocks or any other asset. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds.
Are you a developing or seasoned day trader who trades the U.S. markets? Is the only thing stopping you from getting to the next level is having enough capital to trade? Trade the Pool is a unique online stock trading prop firm that funds stock traders worldwide. Not having to risk your own capital can help you focus on other things like making better decisions on your trades. There's no PDT rules to worry about. You got more than 12,000 stocks and ETFs to trade, long or short, and professional tools at your side. How you get funded is you show them your skills through a straightforward evaluation process. Once you pass the evaluation, you get funded and trade with their pool of money and split the profits. Don't let the lack of buying power, capital, or fear of losing your own money prevent you from taking your trading to the next level. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Today, you are in a research analyst role. Can you just tell us a little bit about what a typical day looks like for you?
As a research analyst, I try to, well, I guess the central tasks for me is to try to think about our existing strategies, make sure they're robust, and try to come up with additional investment strategies. So to that end, I probably spend probably a quarter to a third of my time reading research papers, often academic research papers, and or industry reports to try to brainstorm ideas, think about ideas, and probably another, I want to say a fifth to a quarter of the time discussing ideas with my colleagues, and probably half the time actually prototyping models and playing with data and try to either address client questions with research, or if there are no urgent questions, try to think about try to develop additional strategies.
Right. So it involves a lot of reading, yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
Do you ever run out of things to read?
You know, it's incredible how much research is churned out all the time. So I think I'm constantly falling behind.
Right. So how do you keep track? Like if you're doing a lot of reading like that, how do you sort of keep track of all the information you're taking in? Like does it ever get overwhelming at points? Like how do you manage that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think people do it differently, and I can speak to how I try to organize the information is every time I read a paper, especially an academic research paper, I try to think about what the big question is behind the paper. And typically, good academic papers all have a big question behind them. What I mean by big question is when you read maybe something like the classic Fama-French three-factor model, mechanically you're reading about how these two additional factors alongside the market is able to explain average returns. But the big question behind that is how can we characterize average returns in the cross-section? And for some papers is maybe easier than others, but keeping this big picture in mind helps me sort of put these papers into different categories, and that's very helpful for me in organizing these.
Okay. And do you ever read material outside of academia as well, like maybe some blogs or, other sources as well? Or are you just focused on what comes out of the academic world?
So the academic world is very good for narrow focus and pieces that go quite deep into narrow areas. But at the same time, you want to get broader exposure as well. So certainly sometimes I take a look at blogs. One of my favorites is actually by a former mentor of mine, Frank Diebold at the University of Pennsylvania. He blogs about econometrics and statistics and sometimes, more random stuff. But also newspapers, The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, these are all good places to try to find ideas, because then you get an idea. If you read the less research-oriented publications, you get an idea what is topical, what are people interested in, and maybe you come up with an idea to try to – maybe there's a puzzle in the world that people don't quite understand, and you spend some time thinking about it, and that turns into some interesting research.
Okay. And that blog you mentioned just a minute ago, what's the link to that? Do you know it off the top of your head?
I don't, but I can send you a link later.
Okay, cool. That anyone listening, that can be found in the show notes. Now, do you specialize in any particular asset class?
My time in Chicago, I was trained to have an equities background. But I've found that the statistical tools that you build up as part of your toolkits often translate to other asset classes as well. So my current job, I often look at commodities data as well, and I found actually much of the skills I've accumulated at Chicago actually translates pretty well to commodity futures compared to equities. But you do need to learn new institutional details about any new asset classes that you work in. In terms of specific market behavior, I look at both cross-sectional and aggregate asset-level time series behavior. So I guess at a high level, how do the amount of risk or how risk is priced move over time? And also, how is risk different in the cross-section, across securities or across assets, and how do they vary?
Would you mind just explaining those things in a little more, I guess, more simple terms? Like when you talk about things such as how risk is priced, like can you just go into that a little further and explain what that means?
Sure, absolutely. So I think in modern asset pricing theory, the core of it is really to try to think about the interaction of two quantities. One is called risk quantity and one is called risk price. And risk quantity is essentially how much risk there exists. So we can use maybe the aggregate stock market as a good example here. So how much risk is really associated with holding the stock market, holding the aggregate stock market, let's say the S&P 500. And we think that risk actually maybe changes over time. For example, if you bought equities in Q4 of 2008, maybe the risk is higher compared to if you bought it in March 2009. The other quantity is so-called risk price. And that is for each unit of risk, and it's a little bit abstract here, but I'll try to explain. So for each unit of risk exposure that you hold, how much compensation are you getting? And I think maybe a good way to think about this is if we think about the capital asset pricing model, one unit of risk maybe is market beta equals one. So what do you get when you hold an asset that has a market beta of one? Well, according to the CAPM, you should get the equity premium. If you hold an asset with a market beta of 1.5, then you have 1.5 times as much risk, and you should get 1.5 times the equity premium. So the beta here is risk quantity, and the equity risk premium here is the risk price. It's how much you get awarded for holding on a unit of risk. So I want to think about how do risk quantity and risk price interact, and how do they change over time?
So how are you measuring risk? Like what is, how do you define what a unit of risk is?
Generally, from modern asset pricing theory, maybe starting with Markowitz, we're thinking about risk in terms of standard deviation. So how much can its return vary over time? And how much can that return vary in the cross section? Another measure that I mentioned is market beta. So if your beta is one, then you're holding on to as much risk as if you were holding on to the S&P 500. But if you held market beta 0.5, you only hold on to half as much risk as the S&P 500, and so on and so forth.
And just going back to an earlier point you made, you said that you know, a lot of your education was centered around equities, but, you know, nowadays a lot of your research is centered around commodities. Is there any reason for that, or is it just a matter of the fund you're at is a very commodities-driven fund?
Yeah, I think that's largely it. And I actually had some apprehension in accepting this job, trying to think about how my equities training would translate to commodities, and I was convinced by my current colleagues that the tools I possessed actually did translate from equities to commodities, and fortunately they are largely right. But I did have to really spend a lot of time learning the institutional details of commodity futures. Which are quite different. The market microstructure of commodity futures are quite different compared to equities. For example, futures have a term structure. So when one futures contract expires, you need to figure out how to quote unquote roll into the next nearest futures contract. And that doesn't exist if you hold on to, let's say IBM stock, because that's just a claim on all future cash flows. So once you buy it, you can hold on to it until you sell. You don't ever have to manage it in that. You don't have to sell it and buy it back as you would for futures.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's understandable. I'd love to hear a little bit about your actual like research process. One of the first questions around that I might start with is, you know, how do you actually come up with new ideas for research projects? Like, where do these come from? I mean, a lot of it probably comes from the amount of reading you do, but yeah, can you share a little bit around that?
Yeah, sure. And I think we touched a little bit upon this already. And I think my process is really just trying to read broadly, both academic papers as well as newspapers or magazines, and just try to think about what are some interesting ideas. What are some things that when you read, you're puzzled by? And if you're puzzled by it, chances are many other people are. And if they aren't able to answer it, maybe it's an interesting question and you should think harder about it. I like to keep a research notebook whenever I read so that I can write down any ideas that come to mind. Because it's very hard to know which ideas will work in the end. So all you can do is really try a lot of ideas, throw out the ones that don't quite work, and really focus on the ones that do work. And this process has worked pretty well for me.
Yeah, okay. So is there any like preliminary work you do when you, let's say you have a new idea, right? You put an idea in your notebook. Is there any kind of preliminary work you do, like looking into that idea before you actually decide to invest too much time on an idea that doesn't hold weight? Like, is there anything you can do to kind of filter the good from the bad before throwing away too much time?
Yeah, I think this is extremely important in trying to manage your time for research. So as I mentioned, I like to keep a research notebook and write down basically all my thoughts. And it turns out many of these, unfortunately, are not very good. So what I want to do to filter out the ones that are not very good from the ones that may have some potential is to try to come up with sharp tests. So often these are empirical ideas, so I can test them using data. So I want to come up with sharp tests so I can quickly do a preliminary test to see if the idea has any potential to work. So I would try to think about the sharpest prediction this idea would have and try to think about how to test that in data. And so for each of these ideas, I don't want to spend more than maybe a day or two in really trying to see if they have any value pursuing. And just through this process alone, this probably throws out, I want to say, 70-80% of the ideas already. And then the remaining ones I try to spend more time on and dig a little deeper.
Okay. And just to be clear, when you say sharp, that's got nothing to do with the sharp ratio, does it?
No, it doesn't. I just mean a prediction that can be clearly rejected or not.
So let's say someone's listening to this right now and they're keen to get better at researching their own ideas. Is there anything from your research process that you would suggest less experienced researchers can emulate?
I think the most important thing I would suggest is to try the ideas. Don't just read. When you read, you feel pretty smart often because you're reading stuff that has been published, that you're reading stuff written by other very smart people. So it's easy to sort of fall into the trap of reading too much and not actually trying out ideas. If you don't try the ideas, you never know if they're any good, and you can't really produce any research. So I think you actually learn much more when you're trying out these ideas because you can understand the nuances and the details, which there's no way to get from just reading alone. So my main suggestion is to just try the ideas. Don't be afraid that ideas won't work out. Most of mine don't. But don't just read. And a related point is that ideas change as you try them. But you won't know that, and you won't know how they will change unless you do it. So often what happens is you start out thinking in one direction, and then as you try the idea and as you interact with the data, you realize that maybe your initial hunch is only 50% right, and you have to adjust your direction a little bit. And now your research has taken a slightly new direction. And often you have to do this many times. You have to really iterate this process many times before you get any interesting results at all that are worth presenting or worth discussing. So I think you have to keep an open mind and just try the ideas.
Yeah. And I must say, I like how you point out that a lot of the things you try actually don't work. Like, they don't amount to anything, you know, they are discarded.
Yeah, I think that's not unique to me. From both my classmates and my mentors, my current colleagues, all the empirical researchers I talk to, I think share a similar, not quite frustration in the sense that this is part of research, but a similar experience in that many of the ideas are just, you read something, you write something down, you think it's the greatest idea since sliced bread. You come back to it in a couple of days and you realize, oh, this is actually not very good. That actually happens quite often. And it's okay. That's part of the process.
No, I'm sure a lot of us listening, or a lot of everyone who's listening to this, I'm sure can relate to that on some level. Now, I want to ask you, are there like any, obviously you went through this finance PhD program, and I'm sure you learned a lot during those 5 years. Is there any skills which you use on a day-to-day basis though? Because, some things are nice to know, but you don't use them too frequently. What are some of the tools you possess or the skills or different forms of analysis which you use on pretty much a daily basis?
So I prefer to start my analysis very simple. So I still conduct exploratory data analysis that my maybe second statistics class in college taught me to do. So look at summary statistics, look at histograms, scatter plots, time series plot. Just try to get an idea what the data looks like. And that actually gives you pretty good sense whether your hypothesis has any chance of working or not. And it turns out just simple linear regression actually goes a long way in discovering patterns in the data. If the idea is strong and the empirical findings robust, just a simple regression should show you how it works. So I think despite all the fancy techniques that I have learned in grad school and elsewhere, I sort of still stick to some of the most basic tools to try to construct my thoughts. And you can go to more sophisticated tools as necessary, but you don't want to start with something overly complex, because otherwise you sort of get lost in the details, and you can't really interpret a complex model very well.
So by doing linear regression, what sort of things is that likely to reveal and show to you?
So it's obviously has some drawbacks in that it is a linear approximation to things that are not linear, but often in finance and asset pricing, many things can be linearized. So regression actually is a very good at least initial tool to get an idea of how your hypothesis may work. So and that I think that ties in closely with just looking at scatter plots, just look at time series plots, just look at what the data looks like, actually goes a long way as well.
Okay, yeah. Now, what stands between you as a research analyst coming up with a new idea, something which you think holds weight, has potential? What stands between that point and actually that idea or that new research being implemented into live trading within the fund?
I'm going to answer a little bit more broadly here. I think it depends on your holding period for your investment strategy. If you're going after lower frequency risk premiums, something on the order of months or longer, then I think execution is less important because you're trying to pick up true risk premiums. So you don't need really too heavy machinery for trading if your holding period is a little bit is that long. But if you go into higher frequencies, maybe intraday or days, or of course high frequency trading itself, then execution becomes very important. So you may need to set up serious trading platforms, because execution may be where you make a significant fraction of your profits.
Okay, but do you have to get like this checked off by anyone who might be a level above you or anything like that? Like, are there any processes around there?
Yeah, and I don't want to speak too much about the exact process at my current job, but I think broadly, in investment management firms, that there is certainly a process to go from research to implementation, and I think how big of a step that is, I think depends on what I mentioned earlier about holding period. So if it is a lower frequency strategy and execution is not terribly important, then maybe the language that you did the research in, maybe in R or Python or MATLAB, is good enough. It's fast enough, because you're not trying to go for speed, to sort of just take your research, take your portfolio and implement it. But if you're going for higher frequency, then something like R is probably not going to be fast enough. It's not going to be industrial strength. So you have to either link it to something like C++ or give your code to a financial engineer to code it up in something like C++ so that the code actually runs fast enough to trade in real time.
Okay, and then let's say something is trading in real time. How do you measure the accuracy of your research after that point?
So I think perhaps the best thing, the best metric here is just a out of sample test, a good old fashioned out of sample test of your hypothesis. So anytime you formulate a research strategy, there's going to be some sort of back test if it's a quantitative approach. By its nature, the back test is likely going to be overfitted because you played around with the data for so long. It's inevitable that in some places you sort of tilt the cards in your favor, if you will. So that out of sample is completely new data that you haven't seen, and your hypothesis hasn't mined this new data set. So that I think the best way to judge how good your model is to run it in out of sample period for 6 months, for 3 months, 6 months, whatever time you have, and to compare its performance compared to your back test. And typically, there's going to be some sort of decay compared to the back test because the back test is overfitted. But how much that decay indicates how good your strategy is. For example, if in your back test, your strategy had a Sharpe ratio of 2.5, and in the live period, once you started running the strategy for 6 months, your Sharpe ratio was 1, that means your Sharpe ratio decayed 60%. So in that example, if your back test Sharpe ratio is 2.5, and you start maybe running a paper portfolio or running the strategy live for 6 months and you get a Sharpe ratio of 1, that's a big drop compared to 2.5, which probably means that your back test is not as believable as you might have thought. Whereas in another example, if in your back test your Sharpe ratio is 1.5 and in your live period your Sharpe ratio is 1.2, that difference is quite a bit smaller. So that this shows, at least in the period that you tested, in the out-of-sample period that you tested, your strategy looks fairly robust compared to your back test.
Okay. So is Sharpe ratio one of the measures you use to determine how much decay you're happy with?
Certainly, it's one of the metrics. It's by no means the only metric, and I think different people may focus on, may put different weights on the following metrics, but they all look at returns, cumulative returns, volatility, Sharpe ratio, cumulative drawdown, maximum drawdown, and probably some sort of tail correlation.
Okay. And what do you mean by tail correlation?
So in extreme events, what happens to your strategy? So perhaps in the global financial crisis in late 2008, when the equity markets really dropped quite a bit, what happened to your strategy? Did your strategy drop with the equity market? If so, that means your strategy, that means when equity markets perform really poorly, so does yours, even if normally your strategy may not be closely correlated with equity markets. So these tail events are, really bad outcomes at the extreme ends.
So, Xiao, one of the last things I'd like to ask you about is academic practitioner. Have you found any challenges or a disconnect maybe between the academic research world and actually real world implementation as a practitioner?
I think disconnect is somewhat strong, but I do think that academic research and real world practitioners have different research focus. So naturally they will think about the problem, maybe what looks like a similar problem in very different ways. For example, academia cares about formulating and testing theories, which means abstracting from certain real-world issues, whereas industry cares about implementation. So issues academia ignores becomes very important. So for example, one thing I found after I started working and after I left academia is that trading costs and factory investing and turnover is supremely important. And this is something that doesn't come out of work such as the Fama-French three-factor model. So when you actually try to trade maybe a value or momentum factor, the slippage, so the trading costs you incur and the transactions costs you incur are actually quite important, and maybe as important as the risk premium you found. Another aspect of this is perhaps intermediaries, so how important they are. And I think recent academic finance has started thinking about how important maybe broker dealers or banks, how they matter in the financial system, how they can really make or break the overall financial system. But apparently practitioners have been aware of this for decades, if not longer. So I think it's just due to the nature of their focuses, they think about problems differently, and sometimes they have trouble talking to one another.
How come trading costs are often neglected when it comes to academic research? Like it's something that there's no avoiding it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and maybe to you, Aaron, this is dead obvious. You know, how can you possibly ignore trading costs? It's one of the most important things. But in academic research, trading costs has been relegated to one strand of research called market microstructure. So that's when people study how market participants trade and how they impact prices, how they impact liquidity, and so on. But that's only one strand of asset pricing literature, and it's probably not even the biggest. Right, so cross-sectional asset pricing, on the other hand, is another strand of research that's much bigger. So thinking about size, value, momentum, maybe profitability, and other factors that determine average returns in the cross-section in the absence of transactions costs. And I think that's just because academia needs to break the problem down to very specific pieces and try to dig very deep, understanding each piece. So when you try to understand average returns in the cross-section, academics traditionally have ignored or mostly have ignored transactions cost under this setting. That doesn't mean they don't acknowledge the existence of transactions costs. Just in this setting, studying this particular question, they choose to ignore it. Of course, perhaps to your point, you can't totally ignore transactions costs when you do this analysis. And I think that's precisely the points that practitioners make.
And were there any preconceptions that you had about trading and investing when you made the crossover from being an academic to being a practitioner? Like once you actually started working in the field, were there any preconceptions you had about trading and investing prior to then?
Yeah, I think this is very much related to the disconnect between or to some disconnect between academic research and real world implementation. So as part of my training, I viewed risk premiums as perhaps the most important aspect of a strategy. But I've since learned that it's only one aspect. And trading costs or market microstructure effects are at least as important as the risk premium itself. Market impact is much more important than I previously thought. Liquidity is more important. Even in school, when I spent a lot of time thinking about liquidity, I still underestimated how important it would be for a portfolio strategy. Also, when to rebalance the portfolio turns out to be very important, because liquidity in the marketplace is constantly changing over time. And if you rebalance your portfolio during a large rebalance, let's say the Russell index is rebalanced in June, and you also choose to rebalance in that time, liquidity in the marketplace will be quite a bit deeper compared to if you rebalance at a time that nobody else is trading. The frequency rebalance is also important. And of course, these are just a few points that I realized are at least as important, if not more, compared to just risk premiums themselves, that I think I didn't quite get the perspective while I was in school.
Yeah, no, I think those are all really interesting points that you make there. If someone is keen to find out a little bit more about yourself, I believe you have a website. Do you want to share the link?
Sure. So I can send you the link once again. That's probably the easiest way.
Okay. Not everyone who listens to this will see the show notes though, because some people just listen to it on iTunes, Spotify, etc. Is the link a bit hard to?
That's okay. So if you just Google my name, Xiao Qiao, XIAOQIAO, and you put maybe Chicago after my name, I think it should be the first link you get in Google.
Ah, perfect. Okay, cool.
Yeah, so unfortunately, my name overlaps with like a historical character in a video game. Okay. So if you just put Xiao Qiao, you'll get like this anime girl, and that's certainly not me.
Right, good to know. Do you happen to be on Twitter or any other social network?
I'm not on Twitter, actually. I have Facebook and I have LinkedIn.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm sure someone can find you on LinkedIn as well if they want to. I must say, I really enjoyed this conversation, Xiao. It was nice to speak to you again after meeting, and again, speaking with you at QuantCon. So yeah, thanks very much. I'm glad we got the chance to actually record this and do it as a podcast.
Hey, thanks very much, Aaron. Likewise, I enjoyed our chat very much. Thanks a lot for having me.
Okay, we'll speak soon.
Take care, Aaron.
You've reached the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but rest assured, there are more episodes loaded with real market insight and zero hype on the way soon. So to stay updated with each great new release, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and review. We'll catch you next time on Chat with Traders.